most of the maps that we have will tell you a rough, what they call flow depth, and it tells you kind of what is anticipated for the areas in which you're in. For instance, if you look at the ones for Kodiak, they're color-coded. So you can see like the flow depth, which would range from a event up to 20 feet, all the way from zero up to 20 feet, and the areas that might be impacted. Now understand that these are worst case scenario kind of things. Most of them are determined often like in a 1964 event. So they kind of look at the data and stuff. The good thing about Kodiak, if you look at it this way, is you do have historical data. You guys have been impacted before, so you know where the wave went before and how it hit and stuff like that. However, Kodiak has also changed as far as their infrastructure and your utilities and stuff over the years. So things might have altered a little bit from what was there before. So they try to look at best case scenarios, largest case scenarios, and determine what the possible impact for the community will be.
So last night, well, actually this morning, 100 feet was considered the recommended distance to get away from the tide or the ocean line. Can you correct me on that?
No, you're about right. What we usually do is everybody refers to 100 feet up, 100 feet, or, you know, elevation from in a community. That's just kind of a cover-all, a phrase that we like to say, because we're hoping to get people out of the coastal zone areas or the inundation areas, and 100 feet seems to be a good blanket line to cover for the areas. And it's not all areas in Alaska are that. Some of them are lower, some of them are higher, but just for a general, term to cover everything, it's 100 foot is recommended. Of course, if you feel like you get to 100 foot and you feel like you need to go higher, we don't discourage that. So, it's your personal safety, what you got to do. So, but 100 foot's what we just say is what we recommend for the minimum.
Does the 100 foot minimum still apply under the new maps for Kodiak?
It does. I'm actually trying to look at the pictures right now and see what they say here. It does apply for most of Kodiak area there. It looks like there has been a minor redraw in some parts, but it has it's fairly consistent with the historical events that have already happened there. So it looks like you guys are sticking pretty close to about the 100-foot mark.
Are there any other noticeable changes between our old maps and our new ones, which appear to have been released today?
The major changes that you see is you'll just see the buildup of infrastructure that was not there in 1964. The old harbor that was there has been modified and has changed to this one here. The Coast Guard base has also been modified and changed. So there is some small impacts that that can change from what has happened before. And understand this is when they look at the stuff, they go for maximum worst case scenario. So you can kind of highlight what the areas are. You can put in a maximum estimated inundation on these maps, or you can just look at what the flow depth is. So an event might change, like if this was a 9.2 like the 1964, the maximum line is what they would recommend is the possible inundation. However, a smaller event like this one, 7.9, even though that sounds smaller, but it would be, be nice to say that would be less, but the impacts would still be just as great as in some areas.
Yeah, if I could ask you a second about the magnitude of an earthquake and what it might mean as far as the waves go, or possible tsunamis go, could you kind of give me an idea of what kind of difference there is between, for instance, like a 5.0 earthquake and like the maximum?
Well, obviously, the largest we've had in Alaska has been the 9.2. And so it's kind of important to realize that everything that we look at in SARS Alaska, is kind of already at a measured event that we already know of historically. The every event or every magnitude that goes up by one, so like let's say from a 5 to 6 or a 6 to a 7, goes up 32 times greater. So it's not like the normal scale that people think of as 5 to 10 or, you know, or 10 point magnitude or 10, excuse me, a 10 grade magnitude. So it goes up 32 times. So if a 5 is a 5 pound weight, let's say, and go to a 6, a 5 pound weight would then change to a six, which would be more like, instead of picking up a 5 pound dumbbell, would be like picking up a car. So that's that much more times greater than that. So it increases by 32 times every time.
We had, it looks like, a 7.9 earthquake this morning. Why did that not lead to a larger wave?
The way the earthquake happened, even though it happened on a subduction zone fault line, which is out there on the Aleutian Trench, it actually was a slip fault. So rather than like the 1964 earthquake pushed underneath the North American plate, this one actually slipped alongside of it, kind of like the San Andreas fault one does. So rather than releasing a lot of energy and the ground slipping and releasing a lot more energy into the water column, it actually slipped side to side. And that's why a lot of people felt it for a lot longer. I think you guys said, or some people down there said they felt it for almost a full minute. It's almost like a car skidding on pavement. It enacted in one place and skipped along and slid to another point and then stopped. So you kind of get that slip motion along in the fault lines rather than the push underneath the plate part where it slips and releases energy.
And I think many people are under the impression that there's an earthquake, then there's one tsunami, and that is it, and that's it for the town. But actually, it seems like you can have a series of waves for a long time. Could you kind of talk about the aftermath?
Sure. Yeah, and that is a kind of a false sense of security. People look for this big curling wave that comes in, and you know, some people think that you can go surf on it, but that's not the case. A lot of times, the first initial waves will be a lot smaller than the ones that are coming behind it. The reason being is because the power of the waves are actually pulled farther out into the ocean, where they are actually generated, rather than along the shoreline. So, in some cases, when you're by the shoreline, the water might actually recede before the wave comes in. That happened in 1964 in Chinatka Bay, where the water in the bay actually emptied out and before coming back into the community. And it was, you know, the first wave came in, but it's actually about the third to fifth waves are usually the biggest one because you've got run up of water and material already up inland and it's starting to go back out. Well, now the next wave's coming up on top of that one. So that's why you have larger waves that are usually later on. Plus, you got to remember, this is like the ocean is kind of like a swimming pool or a bathtub. A wave will go be generated on one side, go all the way across, and actually rebound back from another coast and can come back around, or it can actually circle the whole ocean basin and come back around. So usually the waves can be coming later on, and can also be a lot larger. So it is important just to be aware of that situation. The big thing that also happens, especially in the coastal communities like Kodiak, are the harbor currents. It might not be a wave that comes into the harbor, but when the water pressure does decrease or increase in a shorter amount of time than like a normal tidal cycle, it can create great harbor currents. So the tidal currents in the harbors can be generated and be very damaging to boats and commercial traffic.
In which direction did the earthquake come from, or like where was it centered?
The earthquake that we had this morning was centered more kind of. Oh, you see, southeast of you guys, I believe about 100 miles, 125 miles, I believe, and it was actually a little bit farther in the deeper ocean of the Gulf of Alaska, so it wasn't up close to as close to the trench as other ones have been in the past, but it was still close enough to generate a good amount of force and energy. So we have reports of people feeling it from Fairbanks all the way over to Juneau, even out parts of the Aleutians. So it released a lot of energy to shake that much area and to actually wake people up.
And earlier this morning, the original estimated time of arrival was 1:45 a.m. How does the Weather Service know where the tsunami could hit first and what the subsequent places are?
So the tsunami centers that we have in Alaska and around in like Hawaii and international ones. Always do what they call modeling, mapping and modeling, and they always test areas where there's a possibility of earthquake happening and what the a tsunami generated from that earthquake might do. A lot of it's kind of this whole scientific algorithm that they use, but they can actually determine by a certain amount of energy release in a location what the possibility of a tsunami being generated there would be and how it would impact the coastlines or the Pacific area. So they actually produce these maps ahead of time, and then afterwards, when an event happens, they will actually produce another map, seeing what the actual events were, so that they can create a inventory of what the possibilities are. Back in 2011, when we had the Tohoku one over in Japan, there was a very big map put out almost within hours of the energy that was released from that and how it went across the Pacific and would actually impact the Western United States. So we can see those afterwards, and we can compare them what we have for modeling. So what they do basically is they look at certain areas and they can model when an earthquake happens, what the possibility of the travel time of that wave or that force energy, how long will it take to travel across the Pacific Ocean, based off of the what they call the bathymetry of the ocean basin, which is topography basically of the ocean, and how it would impact different shorelines. So based off of just history of what we've learned from the past and what we do for modeling, we can determine how fast basically a wave will travel and measure it and just see how long it will take to get from point A to point B. And so roughly, and we also know from back in the days, the earthquakes that happened in Alaska, especially along the Aleutians, take about anywhere 4 to 5 hours to get to Hawaii. So that's just a kind of good measuring. And so you're looking at about 500 miles per hour travel time.
What agency is responsible for issuing a tsunami warning, and how do they reach out to other agencies to make sure that the line of communication is open?
Well, there's a couple agencies that work together here. The big one is this National Tsunami Warning Center that we have in Alaska here in Palmer, and they're the ones that monitor 24/7. And they will they have actually will look at what earthquakes happen around the globes, and they determine kind of where the locations are, rough estimate of magnitude and impacts. And they can usually do that within about 2 to 3 minutes, the first 2 to 3 minutes afterwards. They'll put out an initial statement to the agencies, other National Weather Service agencies in NOAA, and they'll determine what the possible impacts might be. When something happens like this, a larger scale one, they also locate, or excuse me, they also contact the local state emergency operations centers, especially for ours. That's where I work at here in Fort Richardson in Anchorage. We have the operations center downstairs, which is also manned. And they notify us, and we can actually call communities and alert them to what might be happening. Just give them kind of a heads up of the impacts and possible impacts in their area, what timelines they have, and determine what they need. A lot of times, too, like for you guys, as instance, the fire chiefs and emergency managers down there locally, you guys felt it. So you guys felt it before we probably even knew about it. And so many times they have a direct line of communication to the State Emergency Operations Center. And we can work with the Tsunami Warning Center and get that information to them of what the alerts are, what the impact might be, and just give them the general advisory or warnings or watches, whatever's in place.
How did the government shutdown affect how that message got out?
Luckily, it didn't affect it too bad. The only thing we had was some small glitches on their website that Tsunami Warning Center had, but they were actually able to circumvent that, and it kept it going pretty good. It did draw down a little bit slower as far as people getting information out, or people able to understand the information from the website. But they are actually able to do pretty good with it. So seeing as how we're a state emergency operations center, we're actually under the state government. It didn't impact us at all. We were able to still maintain contact with the communities and still do our duties as we were assigned to. And with the Tsunami Warning Center being a federal agency as well, they were still manned and operated because they're considered essential.
Okay. So, what is it that you do? What's your job description essentially?
Well, actually, I work in what they call the State Mitigation and Planning section, and my official title is the Earthquake and Tsunami Program Manager. And what I do is I help get funding for the state of Alaska to provide like the tsunami sirens that are in communities. To help design and work with University of Alaska Fairbanks in doing those modeling and mapping of the tsunami areas, and work with the earthquake centers. And we produce the evacuation brochures. We help provide signs and evacuation routes for communities as well. We support in training for emergency managers, for community members, anybody who's interested. Actually, we can do presentations. We do presentations in schools and stuff many times. We even bring around the earthquake simulator every once in a while to show people what it's like to get shaken up in an earthquake. So It'll be interesting to see if people can compare that earthquake that you guys just had to what we have in earthquake simulator, because it's almost the same intensity. So
Right.
yeah, so I do run a we work with a grant program also with the National Oceanic Atmospheric Association, and try to get funding for projects for the state to reduce and mitigate the impacts of tsunamis across Alaska.
The inundation maps, one of the main changes, or like the primary changes, infrastructure for this map.
Oh yeah, one of it was infrastructure. They also did have some new updated mapping out into the I know down by Women's Bay area and the Kodiak area out there. They did have some updated mapping that was done by NOAA and also from the U.S. Coast Guard. So when they get those new things, they kind of share them around between each other, and by doing that, they can actually pull up new information and check their actual models and maps, and if there's something significant to change, they'll update that information.
Okay, and so as far as the primary safety information, it hasn't changed very much, like the 100-foot line.
No, everything seems to be pretty much the same. There's a few areas that look like the line might have changed just a little bit, and who knows, that could be maybe earlier maps were off a little bit. But the general information we like to tell people is, 100 feet up and as far inland as you can go, and just be safe and careful. I guess you guys were very populated up there on Pillar Mountain.
Oh yeah, I heard there was a line leading up to the mountain.
Yeah.
And so I vaguely remember some time ago that people had replaced the tsunami sirens around town. So what are some of the measures state agencies have taken over the last few years to make sure that in the case of a tsunami or a tsunami warning that people are prepared and alert?
One of the biggest things we've been trying to do is make sure we get a good outreach campaign going to explain to people the likelihood of earthquakes in Alaska, the likelihood of tsunamis in Alaska, how we were going to get them, what they will feel like, and what you're going to be like. Alaska is number one in pretty much the nation as far as earthquakes go. We have about 30,000 to 40,000 earthquakes a year. Many of them aren't felt. But the thing is, with the thing about earthquakes is when they happen big, and they impact a lot of areas. So the biggest thing we try to get people to understand is what they can do today is just be prepared. Alaska is unique. We're kind of I kind of like to relate us to like the Caribbean, where the Puerto Rican Virgin Islands are right now, where they're an island, and we're kind of an island. Even though we're connected to Canada, we're not able to get goods and services up here as quickly as we can in the lower 48 by road or anything like that. We all know that, we have to rely on the marine system or on the aviation industry or the one road going through Canada to get supplies and stuff up here. So to make yourself prepared and make your family prepared or your business prepared is a big thing. So to try to get that information to what to do to get ready ahead of time, prepare yourself, get yourself an emergency kit, set up an emergency plan for your employees or for your family or anybody around you. Getting certain supplies that you can get and grab and go quickly, so you don't have to worry about things, especially emergency contact numbers and important documents that might get damaged or destroyed. So we've got a whole bunch of stuff on our ready.alaska.gov website that you can go to in the outreach section, and how to make a kit and the information we have to put out there for different businesses or organizations or agencies. So I highly recommend it. The biggest thing is to remember during an earthquake is to drop cover and hold on. And if you're in a coastal community and you feel the ground shaking or you see the water doing something unusual, get to high ground as immediately as fast as possible.
I think it's interesting that you point out Alaska is so unique in the way we respond to most things. And there was a post just recently from someone on our Facebook page, our community Facebook page, Friends of Kodiak, and they're noticing that a lot of the other news agencies in the lower 48 were saying things like, "Oh, Kodiak residents are evacuating, and people think we're evacuating the island." And that's not possible.
No, and that's the thing. A lot of people refer to, I like to refer us to our page, the ready.alaska.gov one, because we have addressed the issues specifically for Alaska impacts, whether it's avalanches or winter storms or earthquakes or tsunamis, stuff. And we have the information from the national side, but we also realize that we don't have the connection to the goods and services that they do. And like you just said, when they say evacuate, they're getting on a highway and driving out of town to go somewhere else, to go to grandma's house or something like that. When you guys get evacuate, it's to get in a car and go sit up on top of a hill somewhere and wait for the emergency personnel to let you know what's going on. And it might be cold, it might be wintertime, it might, it's not going to be maybe a comfy, cozy school somewhere or evacuation shelter. It might be you're up there in the woods or in on a hill in a parking lot for a couple hours or a couple days.
I'd be curious to know a little bit about your experience. What has it been like from the agency side?
For this event, it's been actually very good. Every event we have has been a learning experience. We have tried and we test and practice quite often the methodology of alerting communities and being prepared and try to get out to communities to talk to them. Actually, I was just down in Kodiak this last year with the fire chief down there. We talked about the new mapping and stuff that was coming out, and I went to the Emergency Operations Center, and we worked a lot with the communities because each community is different. I mean, I can go to Kodiak and work with you guys, and you guys will do something completely different than like Valdez will do, or Cordova, or Yakutat. Each community is unique, so we can't just say, go to a community and say, here's what we want you to do, and everybody does this. It's really the unique thing about working with the agencies and the communities is, first of all, getting to know the people that are in the communities, but realizing that I'm not going to tell them in their community what they need to do because I sit in a desk or at a computer in Anchorage when an event is happening in their local back, their local area. So it's important for us to build a good connection for them. So that they feel that they're going to get the supplies and the support they need here that they can't have when an event is going on. So it's been really good to be able to reach out and meet people and to help Alaska. And I'm a born and raised Alaskan, so it's a good pride thing for me to be able to help the people I grew up with.